Dr. Ducking, thank you for doing this podcast with me today from the National Small College Enrollment Conference here in Charlotte, North Carolina. We're fresh off of your keynote address earlier this morning, and I wanted just to have a conversation with you about that and just follow up on some questions I had from that presentation.
Well, thank you for having me, Darren. You know, as I said this morning, these schools are worth saving, and that's unfortunate where we're at right now. So I have great respect for you and everybody else who's here trying to figure out a better way.
Awesome. Well, so I was interested in sort of in your genesis story about moving into program sharing. You talked about kind of the shift from athletic focused growth to program sharing growth, right? And in both cases, you started with the idea of getting into the minds of a prospective student. So I'm just wondering, how did that perspective of the student shape that shift? How did you see that coming and start to evaluate the need to start to not abandon the athletic side, but rather embrace the programmatic side?
Yeah, well, it really was driven by a number of different things. It all happened at once. One was I had four kids of my own, and I watched what motivated them and the types of things they were talking about around the dinner table when they were choosing schools. Secondly, I was doing a lot of reading with successful people in other industries. I mean, Steve Jobs knew everybody would like the internet in their pocket. That's essentially what he figured out. So listening to your customer. But, you know, I've been in this business 35 years. I love the 18 to 22-year-old age range. I still remember my own college experience. And I just asked a very simple question of what motivates students to consider a college. And when I, you know, sort of stepped away from that question and talked to people, certainly athletics matters. And that's one of the things I tried to say this morning. But we're not, as I mentioned earlier, Olympic villages. Kids want to get a degree. They want to get an education. It'll lead to a good salary. And I knew that we weren't offering the kinds of majors, nor could we afford to offer the kind of majors that would, inspire these kids to come to Adrian. So that's when I realized we needed to do something very differently to start new majors.
That's awesome. And was there any signal or student feedback along the way that helped get you to that point? I mean, was it that students were saying, hey, you don't have this or that program that made you start to go down this path or other feedback?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, one of the beauties of being at these small colleges is you can really get to know students. You can do exit interviews with every kid that leaves the school early, and you can ask them, why are you leaving their school? And the number one reason why people left Adrian for many, many years, believe it or not, wasn't money, wasn't student loans, wasn't our housing. It was that we didn't offer their major. Now, you know, we haven't completely solved the problem because a lot of kids will come in, say, for pre-med. It's very, very difficult. They realize, oh, I can't, you know, get the kind of grades that'll get me into medical school, so I'll go into nursing. But we don't have nursing right now. But they also can be inspired to stay if we have basically global health. And so we started global health through the RISE platform. That was enough to keep a lot of pre-med majors at Adrian, and we're trying to figure out a way how to start nursing so we can keep those kids as well. But, you know, it's iterative, and so we cut in half and sometimes by 60-70% the number of kids that said they were leaving Adrian because we didn't have their major.
That's amazing. But then I hear you say that you launched over 30 new majors and minors. It sounds really daunting for a small college. There's so many elements involved. Clearly, you chose to create this public-private partnership that you spoke about with RISE. But how did the consortium-based program sharing make this possible to launch so many new majors so quickly?
Yeah, so two or three different dimensions to your question. One is you're exactly right. I mean, it can be $1 million, upwards of $2 million to start a new major when you look at hiring faculty, giving them office space, retirement plans, salaries, waiting a year for them to develop curriculum, then another 2, 3, 4 years for the major to catch on. I mean, that's a long wait. for one major, let alone 25 to 30 majors like we've started. And essentially what we did was got this consortium together of colleges that said, look, I have supply chain management, or I have computer science, or I have cybersecurity, or I have AI. I will share with you. I just pay a certain amount for each student. I think it's $500 for a kid to sit in a class. Some of it goes to the platform that allows this to happen, the RISE platform. And then some goes to the teaching school, because what I did not say this morning, but what's very important, is that we still keep these classes small. We're not talking about 500 kids coast to coast sitting in an AI class. Once classes get to be about 25, 30 students, we hire another person to teach another section. And so our calling card has always been personal attention at these small schools. And if kids want 500 in a class, they can go to the Ohio States, the Michigan States, or they can go to Coursera, or the University of Phoenix. But for us, the personal attention was very, very important. And so we, that's how we do it. There's a very small, I think, upfront subscription fee to start these majors, just a fraction of what it would cost to hire a professor, and the economics work out.
Wow. So I also heard you kind of hint at the level of involvement that, I guess you talked about project-based learning being a key component, right? And so I'm just curious about how that came about and whether or not you feel like that modality is a key, in addition to the major, is that modality a key ingredient to the success and the retention and the engagement of these students?
Well, it is. I mean, the capstone experience in every single class, which is really what we try to index towards in all the different majors we've studied, everyone has a capstone. That is a real life problem that they can put on their resume. They can say, I saw for this issue. And so that has been very, very important to the popularity of the RISE classes. But then the other thing that's been helpful, and I did talk about this earlier today, is all of our classes are put together with certainly academicians who've studied, the field that they're going into, but also by going out to business and industry. And so, public health, we went out to the World Health Organization and said, what do people need to learn to want to work for, WHO? We went out to Ryder and said, what do kids need to know in supply chain management? We went out to Google and said, what do your current employees, new employees, need to know to be effective? And so we, in the curriculum development part of this whole thing, we have academics, people from professional life, and then people from RISE coming together to put it in a place where it can be delivered online. So we feel like it's been a really good way to engage students. It also takes away that problem, which is something I've been listening to for years as a college president, of these companies saying, hey, we hired people who came through your school, but we need a year, two or three of ramp up just to teach them what they need to know. And that's not good for the student or the corporation. And so we want kids to get off the graduation stage, step into a business, and the business to say, wow, these people have learned through the college experience what we need them to know on day one.
I think the most puzzling piece of the success of this to me is that there's a level of cooperation involved across different institutions. And I'm curious if you could talk a little bit of that. You talk specifically about this being program sharing. And so maybe help us understand the level of cooperation that you have with other institutions when you select or create these models, or how that even comes about. It feels like it's a fairly complicated and complex way to launch, but obviously it's working. But we'd love to hear more about that.
Well, yeah, I freely admit that we have not worked together as a sector to bring efficiency to the system. One of the reasons why college is so expensive is because if I'm teaching French and the college down the road is teaching French and the college, in the next town over is teaching, we all hire our own French teacher. Well, this says, look, maybe one French teacher, now with technology being like it is, able to share, able to work together, is more efficient. And so we have really worked hard to to share faculty, to share classes, and to put it through a platform that allows this to be done much more efficiently and easily than in the past. And so I don't think colleges and universities have done a good job until now to work together for the betterment, really, of students and families and the price tag. Now, we've got a long way to go. We only have 125 colleges that are working together on this. And if you go to the CIC conference, there's 800 or 900 colleges in the Council of Independent Colleges. So the whole universe is 900 colleges. We've only got 125. But I think as time goes on and as more and more colleges realize that this business model that we've existed on for 200 years doesn't work anymore, we can hopefully bring more colleges into the fold.
It is a new model. It's a good way of conveying it. And this level of cooperation in any other sector seems complicated. In higher ed, it seems impossible. yes. But you make a good point that there's also just a need that's driving this. And innovative colleges that get it are coming on board. I wonder about the faculty governance side of it. Not to get too wonky, but if you're going to launch a new program that's going to be shared, does it need to get a certain level of approval at each institution from its own faculty governance for its own credit-bearing course, or is there some other central way that that gets managed?
No, in that way, these new majors go through the same faculty governance system that they've gone through at every institution for every year. So at Adrian, my faculty had to approve each and every major that we now offer students. And they had to look at, the learning outcomes, the quizzes, the tests, the syllabi. They had to understand what is going on here in terms of the curriculum, and is it worthy of an Adrian College degree and Adrian College credit? So my faculty approved it. Every other institution has their own way of doing it. The faculty approve it everywhere. To get through the accrediting agencies, they have to be faculty approved. That has always been sort of the standard by which colleges, offer classes. And we haven't changed that. Now, my faculty said to me, look, we don't want you to replace existing majors. And so if we had computer science and we had faculty in those areas, they didn't approve a computer science major to be taught elsewhere, and then I get rid of all my CS professors. That's not how it works. But they've said, look, this is additive. And the faculty, I think, are being smart these days as they see institutions close and that they're saying, hey, this is existential. We've got to make some changes. We've got to work with the administration. And so over 650 majors have been passed over the last few years everywhere around the country.
Yeah, that's really impressive. And I would imagine, the fact that faculty can come on board with this and actually be a partner in the process makes a really big difference. I want to understand a little more about the student decision-making process. You actually were talking quite a bit about students' perspective in your talk, which I really appreciated. But so much of this strategy is about understanding what they really want out of college, right? And so what's one of the biggest misconceptions colleges have about the student decision-making process today and how they think?
Yeah, I think I cited a statistic that's true, that back in the 60s and early 70s, 90% of the kids that went to college said they were going primarily to get a better understanding and philosophy on life. And now 90% of students say they're going to college to get a better job, to make more money, which we know translates into being able to pay off their student loans, live in a safer neighborhood, provide for their families, all the things that come with having more income. And so that does drive students to schools. It certainly drives them to certain majors that we were not offering before, couldn't afford to offer before because so many are in technology and the healthcare sciences. And that's the motivating factor for a lot of students. Now, what I also believe is that students want the total experience from college. They want to live in a dorm, meet new people, eat in the dining hall, be in student government, go to chapel at religiously based schools, et cetera. So that sort of 360 experience is very, very important. But the major stands at the center of that for many students. And when you only have 40 or 50 majors, as we did at Adrian for many, many years, to now be able to have 80 or 90 majors without having to pay $1 million to start each one, That's the new business model. That's the difference maker. That's bringing efficiency through working together.
That's terrific.
I guess I'm curious if you're talking, and I'm sure you talk to many college presidents around the country, when somebody's contemplating getting involved, starting to consider a strategy like Adrian did and so many other colleges have today with program sharing like this, what's sort of the first hurdle or what's sort of the first step for them to getting on the right path here? Is it an internal conversation? Is it a landscape analysis of sort of their local community and what their students are looking for? Where do they start?
Yeah, well, I sit in the corner office, right? So I'm in the president's chair, and I think that presidents really need to start at the same place, or start in two places simultaneously. They certainly need to start with their faculty because they need their faculty on board to say, yeah, we'll listen to new majors and start new majors and approve new majors. But they also need to talk to their board of trustees because boards have finance committees, and boards are looking at the numbers, and they don't want to see red ink when they come to campus three times a year. And presidents report to boards. And this is something that is very, very disruptive to higher ed and many local institutions. So I needed my board of trustees behind me. And I went to my board chair immediately with this idea and said, hey, I want to bring these two guys on that are going to build a platform. But people are going to be unhappy about this. And so I got the board behind me at the same time that I got the faculty to play ball with me on the new majors. And then I think that there's enough out there in the popular press. You know, Burning Glass is a great example of a company that does a lot of looking into these statistics. And they're saying this is where the migration is happening with 17 and 18-year-olds. And then the next place that they need to listen is certainly the local community. In Michigan, that's why supply chain was big for us, right? All these car factories, parents working on the line saying, I don't want you working in a factory. Go into supply chain. There's a lot of jobs. There's Amazon. There's all packages on everyone's doorstep every morning. Go into supply chain. And so it's really sort of having many balls up in the air at the same time. But faculty and trustees are the two biggies.
Makes a lot of sense. So looking ahead, what key trends do you think small colleges have to pay attention to if they want to remain competitive and relevant going forward?
Yeah, well, I think the key trends that I would suggest are obviously starting new majors, as we've talked about here, but really providing what we call the 360 experience, where the kid realizes, hey, if I go away to college, I'm not just going to be up in a dorm room somewhere, you know, taking all my classes online. The average kid wants to take two classes online, two classes on the ground. So we still have a very robust, you know, on the ground, traditional, know your professor type of experience. So that's not going away. I don't want that to go away. They want some athletics. They want the co-curricular experience. They want to meet, boys want to meet, you know, young women and vice versa, which is also important and part of where you're at that point in your life. And they want a safe environment. They want secure. I mean, that whole sort of Norman Rockwell painting that has been the American education experience and is really the envy of countries around the world. This is still where people want to go to college.
100%.
We've got to preserve the best things that have gotten us to where we are today while bringing this modicum of efficiency to change the business model.